It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. If you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. Choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, a deep dive crime podcast which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Today I'm going to be covering a case that you guys asked me to do. In fact, I've got a massive list. I'll be here in 100 years still doing it because the list is so long. But this one is on BTK. So, because you asked, I have decided to cover it. I know it's been covered in lots of other areas by lots of other YouTubers, but why not give you my take on a crime that terrorized Wichita, an area of Kansas, for over 30 years. 30 years! That man got away, literally, with murder. That's insane, isn't it? That somebody can literally get away with 10 murders over 30 years. And seemingly, if it hadn't have been for a little mistake that he made at the very end of it, chances are, he would have got away with it, full stop. For over 30 years, an area of Kansas was terrorized. The whole area was convinced that one day they would walk into their home and meet, essentially, the Grim Reaper. And one of the things that was really significant throughout this case was that when you look at the type of criminal you're dealing with, they come as organized or disorganized. And where serial killers are concerned, it's quite hard to be an organized serial killer. But BTK was an absolute master of being organized. And when you're an organized serial killer who also kills random individuals, or at least seemingly random to the people around the area, to the police, for example, it's very challenging to know how to pinpoint who's actually done it. Bear in mind as well, we're talking about this happening probably over 40 years ago now, when you work out how long ago it is since he's gone to prison. But because of that, technology was way less sophisticated than it is today, which means that, as a lot of killers are, they're sitting at home thinking they've got away with it, but actually it's just a matter of time and a bit of patience before DNA catches up with them. Wichita was considered the buckle on the Bible Belt, so it's a very religious area. People felt incredibly safe there. It was the type of place that you left your doors open and people could wander in as neighbours and you were not concerned. Crime was non-existent. It was a very much God-fearing place, meaning that residents there genuinely felt like they were living in one of the safest places they could have ever imagined. So this particular killer didn't just terrorize this area for a short period of time. You know, you're talking two generations of police officers were searching for this killer. So who was Dennis Rader? Well, he does stand out a little bit. He's a little bit like Ted Bundy in this respect. He was born in 1945 in Pittsburgh, Kansas. And essentially, his childhood was not considered dysfunctional. He grew up in a relatively nice environment. He wasn't abused by people. It turned out, as far as people were concerned, he had a relatively nice life. His school wasn't too terrible. He may have been bullied a little bit, but there certainly wasn't anything striking that would make you think, attachment disorder, abandonment issues, sexual abuse, being terrorized by a horrific parent, alcoholism, drug use, and so on and so forth. It wasn't like that in his home. So when he was growing up, he didn't stand out to any intents and purposes as an individual who could end up being so catastrophic to the community in which he lived. He was born on March the 9th, 1945. He grew up in Wichita. He was the oldest of four sons and he had a normal childhood. That's what people say. From a really early age, he exhibited zoo sadism, which is basically the torture, killing, hanging of small animals. But also, he had some strange sexual fetishes, shall we say. Voyeurism, so he liked looking at sexual things that were occurring that he wasn't involved in. Autoerotic asphyxiation. That's something that if you Google, you'll notice that people in Hollywood have died. There's been some quite famous people who've died of autoerotic asphyxiation. It's where you choke yourself to a point where when you orgasm, because you are near death, apparently, I cannot comment as to whether this is true, but apparently it exacerbates the level of orgasm you experience. You can also kill yourself, which has happened on several occasions. I can recount several people in the public eye who've done it. That's how dangerous it is. But for whatever reason, some people really enjoy it. He was also a cross-dresser. He spent a lot of time being a peeping Tom, trying to look through windows where people were getting dressed. And he would also steal underwear from the local area. So he'd end up running into somebody's garden, removing your knickers and running off again. He would also use things like ropes to masturbate, and when he was masturbating himself, he would often bind himself. That was something that would remain with him throughout his entire career. No doubt if he gets ropes in prison, I would imagine he would offer himself the opportunity to do that there. It's something that's really stuck within his mode. His paraphernalia is definitely binding and BDSM. So he managed to pass through school and college pretty unnotably, although we have to recognise that those kind of behaviours with animals and autoerotic asphyxiation are definitely not the norm. He did go into the US Air Force, but he dropped out. And after he did that, he returned to Wichita, where he married his wife, Paula. That was in 1971. At that point, he took a job with an outdoor supply company for about a year, but then he started with ADT Security Services, and he was there pretty much for his entire career. So he was somebody who could create a responsible service attitude. He was obviously an individual who could get on well with his peers, people he worked with, and his marriage, strangely, was happy. So when you think about his childhood, relatively normal. When you think about his work service, pretty damn good. And then you think about his marriage. It was a good marriage. So we're talking about a Jekyll and Hyde character right now, because this is somebody who's a chameleon. When I talk to you about the kind of crimes that he got involved in, and also I'll try to relay the way that he was when he talked about these, because I've listened to all of his admissions, I've watched him interviewed and taken to court, and I've watched him give his evidence in court. Chilling. It's like watching somebody just having a chat about the day, but you will see that he undoubtedly was able to compartmentalize what he did where murder was concerned and compartmentalize the rest of his life in another area, because it's unfathomable how somebody could have killed these people over this amount of time and also been a stand-up guy. A guy that colleagues said, you know, if I was having a bad time and I needed to be escorted down a dark alley, I would choose Dennis Rader to do that. That's the kind of chameleon he was. So throughout his childhood, adolescence, early years essentially, there's nothing that the public would have been able to say, Dennis Rader, definitely the kind of guy that's going to end up a serial killer. That's what makes him stand out. Like I said, there are comparisons there to Ted Bundy, again, an individual who didn't really stand out. Now, coming to the murders, they were horrific. They were random as far as there wasn't a pattern. It's not like Dennis Rader went for a specific type. You know, he didn't go for blondes in their 20s who worked in retail. You know, there are killers who actually go for specific types of individuals. They remind them of somebody, or they're rageful about an individual who had spurned them early on in life. So they go for that kind of prototype. Dennis Rader didn't fit that. It's what made him very, very difficult to find. On the 15th of January 1974 is when Dennis Rader begins his serial killing career. And it was a horrific scene that police walked into. On January the 15th, 1974, Dennis Rader strangled to death four members of the Otero family in their Wichita home. There were the parents, Joseph and Julie, and two of their children, Josephine and Joseph Jr. To be fair, when you actually watch Rader talk about these murders, he didn't think that Joseph was going to be present. He did like to select homes where the husband wouldn't be there because obviously it was easier to overpower a woman. But he did like it when children were there because obviously that's a bargaining tool, isn't it? You can get usually a mother to do anything if she thinks she's going to protect her children. That's a very clever psychological tactic to use. If you think your children are under threat, you're going to do whatever you're told to do to ensure their safety. So first of all, when he goes into the house, he's armed and he basically tells the same story that he tells to pretty much all of his victims, that he's a wanted man and he needs a car. And then he proceeds to tie people up. And obviously at this moment, they're kind of saying, look, take the money, take whatever there is. But they don't realize that that isn't the plan that Rader has in his head. So when he ties them up, they're imagining that this is going to come to an end, but it doesn't. So initially he strangles Joseph and then he strangles Julie and then he goes into Joseph Jr.'s bedroom and he strangles him. But this is the first time. Remember that when you're choked, very often you pass out, and Dennis Rader hasn't murdered before. So he hears noise in the room that Joseph and Julie are in and he goes back. And then again, he strangles them again. And this goes on for a while because it's actually a lot more difficult to strangle a human being than you would imagine. He then wraps t-shirts around their heads. He puts plastic bags around their heads. And then finally, that means that they die. He then has to go and do the same to Joseph Jr. because he's woken up again. He wraps t-shirts and plastic bags around his head. So he suffocates. A horrible, drawn out death. But Josephine's death is different because she has been the target. What you see about Dennis Rader is that he does something called trolling. And trolling is something that he does to look around the areas where he's searching for victims. He doesn't know what kind of victim. He just knows that at some point he will see somebody and they will become a project. He refers to people as projects. And once he locks in on those individuals, then becomes the stalking phase. So there's a real staging to the progression leading to the murders. And Josephine is who he's been stalking. So the ones that he's murdered before her are kind of collateral damage. She's the one he wants. She's a child. But he gets Josephine. He has choked her, first of all, but he's not killed her. And he takes her down to the basement. And then over a period of time, and it's a drawn out period of time, and this is a child, he hangs her over a beam. So he hangs her as she chokes, nearly dies, then he lets her come back to life. And he hangs her, and then he lets her come back to life. And he does this essentially to gratify himself sexually. After he murders her, he masturbates, and he actually leaves semen traces at the home. He then takes a watch, and he takes a radio, and he leaves. The strangulation and souvenir taking would be a part of his MO. It was a thing that he would do because it could help him relive the experience of those murders. But that's a horrific thing. Just take a step back from what I've said. He's gone in and he's wiped out four of that family. The only reason the other children didn't get killed was because they were at school when this happened. But imagining Josephine's last moments, imagining her mother's last moments, knowing that the likelihood is that her children are going to be murdered. You cannot even begin to comprehend that horror, can you? He said in court he derived a lot of sexual pleasure from that killing. It was the Otero's 15-year-old son, Charlie, who came home later that day that discovered the bodies. And he couldn't even call the police because one of the things that Dennis Rader had done is he cut the phone lines. So he was really clever about the way he carried out this murder. And when the detectives came to the home and found the scene, I mean, you can't imagine it, can you? Wichita was a state where very few murders happened. And if they did happen, it would be more domestic. So it would be a standard domestic abuse scenario gone wrong where somebody had ended up dead. or it was one where somebody shot someone by mistake. It was those kind of killings. They were not used to a crime that was premeditated and calculated. I mean, what was equally dreadful about this situation was that the Otero family had only just moved in to that house. That's how unlucky they were. Joseph was a veteran and his wife Julie worked at the local factory. And when the police found them, Julie and Joseph were both face down in the bedrooms. As I said, they both had been strangled with bags over their heads. And when he's in court, when he talks about this, he just keeps going on about how they kept coming round. Can you imagine just keeping coming round? So now we know exactly what those individuals went through. It must have been the most harrowing experience.
Did he in fact suffocate and die as a result of this?
Not right away. No, sir, he didn't.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
What happened?
Well, after that, I did Mrs. Otero. I had never strangled anyone before, so I really didn't know how much pressure you had to put on a person or how long it would take. But
was she also tied up there in the
bedroom? Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, both her hands and their feet were tied up. She was on the bed.
Where were the children?
Josephine was on the bed, and Junior was on the floor this time.
So we're talking, first of all, about Joseph Otero. So you'd put the bag over his head and tied it, mm-hmm. and he did not die right away. Can you tell me what happened in regards to Joseph?
He moved over real quick-like, and I think tore a hole in the bag, and I could tell that he was having some problems there. But at that time, the whole family just went, they went panicked on me, so I worked pretty quick.
You worked pretty quick.
Well, I strangled Mrs. Otero. And she went out, or passed out. I thought she was dead. She passed out. Then I strangled Josephine. She passed out, or I thought she was dead. And then I went over and put a bag on Junior's head. And then, if I remember right, Mrs. Otero came back. She came back and...
Certainly asked you about Joseph Otero Sr. You indicated he had torn a hole in the bag. Mm-hmm. What did you do with him then?
I put another bag over it, or either that or a... I recollect, I think I put a... either a cloth or a T-shirt or something over it, over his head, and then a bag, another bag.
Did he subsequently die?
Well, yes.
So now in January 1974... the police are searching for this killer. They've got no leads. And initially they're playing with the potential that it could be a revenge attack, i.e. somebody's very angry with the Oteros and they've come in and murdered them because of that. But they fall on the likelihood that actually it's a sexual one, because the evidence that's been left by the scene, also the way that the daughter has been hung, and the fact that it seems like there was a specific reason to kill the three others so that he had time with Josephine by herself. They do manage to get some seminal fluid, and they can find through that he was a blood type 0. That's about 40% of people who carry that. So it's a really common one. So even though they've got that information, and they can obviously keep storing that rest of that information for future focus, the truth is that it doesn't really give them any leads at all. Now, Raider strikes again a few months later on April the 4th, 1974. Now, he's waiting in the apartment of a young woman called Catherine Bright, but he is not well prepared for this. In court, he can't remember whether he actually took his own murder kit. He tends to have a murder kit which has got duct tape, ties, ammunition, guns, knives. But on this occasion, he recalls that he's not sure that he was actually that organised. So he waits in her apartment, imagining that she's going to come home by herself. But she doesn't. She comes home with a family member called Kevin. And that completely throws him. So again, he tells them both, I'm somebody who needs a car, I'm wanted, and I need to tie you up. Initially, he gets Kevin to tie up Catherine. And for whatever reason, Kevin doesn't tie Catherine that tightly. And I would imagine that's because he doesn't want her to be bound. And it's probably a clever way of thinking, well, maybe if I don't do it too tightly, she'll be able to escape. Raider then ties up Kevin, but again, not as tightly as he should have. He puts him down, strangles him, and then goes to do the same to Catherine. However, Kevin isn't out for the count. And Kevin's actually able to describe after this incident that this average-sized guy with bushy mustache and psychotic eyes attacked me. But the attack starts to go wrong because Kevin starts being able to get out of his binds and starts to get up. So of course, Dennis Rader goes back into the other room, starts to have a fight, and he shoots Kevin. Kevin goes down. Rader at this point thinks, I've definitely killed him. He then goes back in, carries on with Catherine. Catherine at this point is fighting, and yet again, he hears that Kevin is moving around. But then he hears the noise again in the other room and he goes back. Poor Kevin at this point, you can imagine, he's been strangled, he's been shot, and he's still trying to fight, and Raider shoots him again. He then returns to Catherine, who's got out of her binds. She's screaming and fighting. He gives up on the strangling and he just stabs her to death. So this is a really disorganized, bloody scene. And at that point, he finds that Kevin is running out of the door and down the street. So somehow, Kevin has been shot twice, he's been strangled, and he's still managed to escape. Also at this point, the phone rings and it's like Dennis Radar's trance has been broken. He even thinks that when he hears Kevin leaving the house, that it's the police coming to get him. Totally freaks out. He grabs his murder kit, or what he thinks might have been a bit of his murder kit. He doesn't know whether he actually took it or not, but whatever he needed, he kind of cleans it up a little bit and then he runs. He takes the keys, thinking that he can steal one of their cars to get him away from the scene. Doesn't happen. They're the wrong keys. Eventually, he just throws the keys and he runs. And he runs all the way back to where he'd left his car. So he has to run all the way. So this is a scene that could have gone awfully wrong for him. One, because now somebody is a witness. Two, because he couldn't get away quickly enough. Three, because you would imagine that there would be some alerting to a man running from a place probably covered in blood. But nothing happens. He gets away with it. Now, police are following up every single lead at this point, but they are getting nothing. So now we're up to 4 deaths and 1 attempted murder as well. In October 1974, a really strange thing happens. 3 men individually come forward and say they were the people who carried out the murders. I don't understand the psychology of people who do that, but it is relatively common, chaps. It's relatively common for people to come forward and say, it was me. But obviously, it wasn't them. But nonetheless, the police would be investigating it at this point. It is a dream of a police officer that somebody walks off the street and says, I am the person responsible for those murders. It's kind of done and dusted then, isn't it? And this is a really scary time for people in Wichita. People are being murdered and they want to catch the person. So this gets into the press that these guys are saying it was me. Bit of a Spartacus moment there. It was me. It was me. It was me.
I just want to shout out BetterHelp, who is my sponsor today. I'm a therapist. I spent 20 years working in the field. And the reality is, I think that therapy is amazing. And BetterHelp is bringing it into your homes all over the world. BetterHelp Online Therapy assesses your needs and can match you with your own licensed professional therapist in less than 48 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional therapy done securely online, and it is available to people worldwide. You can log into your account anytime. You can send a message to your therapist. You can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you don't have to be on camera if you don't want to. And getting therapy every week is as easy as a few clicks away on your laptop or phone. And in therapy, you know it can take a few tries to find the right fit for you. So BetterHelp makes it easy and free to change therapists. You know, if you don't feel that they're the right therapist for you. It's more affordable than traditional online therapy, which is great, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp is an amazing way to invest in yourself. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they're actually recruiting additional therapists in all 50 states in the US. And they have a special offer for you guys, my true crime viewers. Get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/bang. That's 10% off your first month of online therapy at betterhelp.com/bang. But the person who really has carried out these murders is not happy. Not happy at all. Because they know that they're responsible. And they don't want any Tom, Dick and Harry getting away with claiming that it was their work when it was actually his. So he sends a letter to the police, and it is a very, very detailed letter. And I mean so detailed, including where Josephine's glasses were left, for example, in the house. How many bags were placed on the head, the t-shirts that were placed on the head of the Otero's murders. It was stuff that only the killer would have known. Now, I have to say, occasionally this happens with serial killers, that they contact the police, but it's pretty unusual behaviour to correspond this way. And it definitely suggests malignant narcissism. And this type of narcissism means that they believe that they are so superior to other people that they are incapable of making mistakes. And because they believe that, they also feel this desire for other people to realize how superior they are. They want people to see that they are better than other killers. They are better than the investigators who can't find out who they are. It's this desperate need for attention. So he went to great lengths to ensure that the police found the letter. He took it to a local library, hid it between some books, and they called a newspaper reporter. And he basically taunted the police with it. "It's hard to control myself. You would probably call me psychotic with sexual perversion hang up." So that shows you, doesn't it? That malignant narcissism. I know so much. I even know what's wrong with me. You're probably relating and referring to me as this. But he also said, "When this monster enters my brain, you will never know. Maybe you can stop him. I can't. He's already chosen his next victim. The code words for these will be bind them, torture them, kill them. BTK. They will be on the next victim." I mean, imagine getting that letter. It's terrifying. Because firstly, it's just showing that he has no desire to stop. Secondly, that he's enjoying it. Thirdly, that he believes he has no control over this demonic force that takes over him. But most importantly, that he's planning the next kill. He's a classic psychopath. Because he can absolutely separate and compartmentalize his behavior. Note how he refers to himself in that letter. He's referring to himself as not really being in control of his actions. It's almost like something takes over him. So he's compartmentalizing his behavior this way, separating what is taking place, i.e. the murders, from his involvement within it. Shows the low accountability, the low responsibility, the high dangerous behavior level there. It's huge. So Raider is now becoming BTK, isn't it? You can hear that he really wants to own some kind of notoriety. And that's something that becomes really, really present as we go through this case. In 1977, we have his next victim. This is one that really sticks with me because of the fact that Shirley Vian was 24. She was off work. She was really sick that day. Her kids were at home because she was unwell. Obviously, you imagine how it is. We've all been there as parents, haven't we? Where we're looking after our kids, but we're feeling really diabolical. And she probably just wanted to sleep. And he walked in off the street. And the reason that he did this was because he wasn't going to go to Shirley Vian's place at all. He'd selected someone completely different. He'd been trawling and decided on a project on a completely different human being. But that person wasn't in that day. And he'd noted that a young boy was walking past when he was trying to get into this particular property that he'd chosen and selected the victim of. So he actually called to the boy and said, "Hey, I'm a detective.
can you look at these particular IDs for a photo? And the boy kind of just ignored him and carried on. But Dennis Rader wasn't stupid. If there was a child, there was going to be a mother. So he kind of watched where that child had gone. And then he followed. That was the house of Shirley Vian. He walked in, immediately threatened her, said that he was going to need to tie her up because he had these sexual issues, and to make those sexual issues okay, he would have to tie her up and rape her. Obviously, she's got three kids who are hysterical. He wants to tie them up as well, but it kind of all gets very chaotic. So in the end, he agrees that the children can be locked in the bathroom. Can you imagine how Shirley's feeling at that moment, putting her children in the bathroom? But she barricades them in. And I think the reason that she was so willing to barricade them in is she's hoping to put as many blockers between this psychopath as she can with her children. So she's engaging with this. She's enabling this. He then lets her have a cigarette because she's obviously terrified. And then he says that he's going to take her to have sex with her. She's actually violently sick at this moment in time. That's how wound up she is. She's already ill. So he helps clean her up. He even says in court that he comforts her. What a strange thing to do. He comforts her. And he takes her into the bedroom. He ties her to the bedpost. And he uses the same rope that he binds her feet with to strangle her with. And again, that goes on for a while. It's broken when he hears the phone go. And again, this is because he's living a fantasy and the fantasy has been broken. But also, she has made it clear that somebody is going to come and check on her because she isn't very well. So he realises that it probably isn't safe to stay and removes himself from that environment. He leaves the children. They would definitely have been victims otherwise. Remember, he is indiscriminate about who he kills. He just wants to kill. He then leaves that house and he calls the police. He calls the police. When he talks about this in court, one of the things that he brings up about this particular case is the way that she resigned herself to the rape. After she's had the cigarette, after she's been sick, just before he ties her up, she says, okay, you better get this over with and then I can call the police. There's something about that resignation in there, isn't there? Just something about that knowledge that this man is going to do what he wants to do to me. But when he was tying her up, I bet she had absolutely no idea that he wanted to murder her. And it's this sexual sadism that he loves. He enjoys it. The more terror and fear that he can elicit, the better. You know, that's slowly taking them to the edge of death, but then letting them come round. Slowly taking them to the edge of death and then letting them come round. And it just demonstrates the complete desire to choose whether somebody lives or dies. As I said, what's really unlucky for Shirley Vian is that she wasn't the victim. The real victim was a target called Cheryl Sarkozy. She was out, she lived with a housemate, and they'd gone out that day. But Shirley Vian's son had actually seen Dennis Rader knocking on the door of Cheryl's house. How terrifying is that? Imagine knowing that you had been the victim, that Dennis Rader, that BTK, had come to kill. She recalls that she had triple locks put on everything and she would spend nights in bed convinced that she was going to be murdered. Ironically, a year after that murder took place, Cheryl's housemate came eye to eye with who she believes was Dennis Rader. She had a strange feeling. She went to the window and there, staring directly in at her, was a man who fitted his description, and she genuinely panicked like hell. And her and Cheryl grabbed the phone, rang the police and sat under their table convinced that they were going to be murdered. So it could be that BTK came back to finish the business that he'd started. Just after the murder of Shirley Vian in January 1978, Rader sent a poem to a local newspaper about the Vian killing. Can you imagine that? Sending a poem to a local newspaper. He also sent a letter to a local television station taking responsibility for the murders and for other murders. And he also suggested in that letter that he was responsible for other killings. So we know that he really wants people to be aware of what's happening in his life, that he's carrying out these murders. He's enjoying it. And you kind of
creating this picture that this man is not going to be happy unless the world knows about him, unless he's notorious for what he's done. And despite this cat and mouse game with the authorities, we have to acknowledge that he managed to keep his lid on this secret murderous life. You know, at this moment in time, when you look back at what's happening in his life, he's a really attentive husband. He and his wife have now got a son in 1975 and a daughter in 1978. All the while, he's getting himself educated. Rader graduates from Wichita State University with a degree in the administration of justice. Little bit ironic there. Choice of course, but never mind. But even though he's playing out this perfect family person, he's constantly taunting the authorities, constantly letting them know it's just a matter of time. I'm ready to strike again. It must have driven the police mad, because they are professionals. This is what they do. They bring people to justice, and this man is running rings around them. Now, one of the things that's unusual about BTK is he's not somebody who stops serial killing, but he is somebody that takes quite long periods of time between killings, because part of his enjoyment isn't just the kill. He's much more organized. What he likes to do is to set his sights on a certain person. It could take months, even years in his words, to find the perfect victim. He would troll the area he intended to kill in for months and even years. They were family friendly areas because they were the areas where women were likely to be at home alone in the day. And when he was in court, he would talk extensively about he would trawl and then lock in on his victims and then create a project and then stalk and then kill. In fact, he constantly refers in court to, I don't know whether you know about serial killers, as if like he was a massive expert. Obviously, he is a serial killer. He has a subjective experience of it, but he's very arrogant. He almost wants to let the people in the courtroom know that he's the expert here. He's the person who understands serial killers. And he'll constantly say to the judge, I don't know whether you know, or, well, what happens when serial killers do? And it's almost like this guy who's a judge who obviously has had much experience of criminal behavior, but he's almost superior in his opinion to the judge. And he's educating everybody around him, which is shocking to watch. Because all the way through, you're looking at this man just like casually saying how he's murdered, what he's done, how he killed, how he planned it. And it could be talking about what he did at the weekend with his friends.
Then I proceeded to tie her up. She got sick, threw up, got her a glass of water, comforted her a little bit, and then I went ahead and tied her up and then put a bag over her head and strangled her.
All right. Was this a plastic bag also?
Yes, sir. I think it was. But I could be wrong on that.
Okay, you put a bag.
It was something. I'm sure it was a plastic bag, yeah.
You say you put a bag over her head and strangled her. What did you strangle her with?
I think on that I had tied her legs to the bedpost and worked up with the rope all the way up, and then what I had left over, I looped over her neck.
All right, so you used this rope to strangle her.
Yes, I think it's the same one that I tied her body with.
The next murder was of 25-year-old Nancy Fox. She lived alone. She had got home late after working two jobs. And one of the reasons that he was getting good at this particular type of murder was because, as he brought out in court, he got a lot of intelligence that he gathered on them. So after he trawled that victim, locked onto them, he'd stalk them. He even visited places that they worked at times. On occasions, he went twice to a victim's workplace just to kind of scope it out, to feel like he knew what their movements were more. He knew what cars they drove, the times that they'd come in at night. He was enjoying knowing that he was a predator. And it wasn't just about that instantaneous gratification. It wasn't just about knowing that he could go and murder them. It was the planning. It was the execution of that planning that titillated him as well. He got a lot of sexual gratification from the weight and anticipation behind the hunt. On December the 8th, 1977, she returns home and he's waiting. And he hangs her to the brink of death. And then again, he lets her come round. It's this constant pattern
He enjoys that feeling of being God. And he really gets a kick out of this particular murder. He really enjoys it. 8:18 the following morning, he rings the police. He tells them where the body is. So he wants people to know of his work. And he wants the police to know, you weren't quick enough. You weren't quick enough. And now look what's happened. Another person's dead. Total narcissism. It's the, you can't catch me. They did trace the phone box that the call was made from, but it didn't give them any leads. Obviously, there would be lots of fingerprints on there. It wasn't something that could lead them to him, but they did make the effort to do that. 2 months after that phone call was made, a package arrives in Wichita TV station, and in it is a letter and a poem. And the poem is called Ode to Nancy. This is how it reads. What is this that I can see? Deep, cold, icy hands taking hold of me. For death has come, you will all see. Hell has opened its gate to trick me. Oh death, can't you spare me over for another year? I'll stuff your jaws till you can't talk. I'll bind your legs so you can't walk. I'll tie your hands till you can't take a stand. And finally, I'll close your eyes so you can't see. I'll bring sexual death unto you for me. I mean, I'm going to say it like grade D poetry there, really average. But when you think that this is based on reality, how terrifying is that? So again, can't you just see how this man operates? He's living this constantly. It doesn't matter whether he's actually physically murdering people. He's got so many things that he's taken from the scene of crimes, like jewelry, for example, a radio. Therefore, he can constantly relive the experience. He's constantly planning his next move, meaning he's got loads of gratification from that knowledge. He's trawling, and then he's locking in on potential victims, and then he's stalking them. He's really, really spending a lot of time doing these things. So for him, even though you could say, well, he doesn't kill for a certain amount of years, so it doesn't matter. He's constantly killing. It's just his victim isn't dead yet. That's the key. They are dead people walking. He's locked in on them. The only decision that hasn't been taken is when they'll actually die. It's around this time that BTK becomes officially BTK. We know that he's already sent letters saying bind, torture, kill, but he hasn't necessarily been officially referred to that in the press. He writes to the police and says, look, what are you going to call me? BTK, the asphyxiator, and he gives about seven different names that they could offer him. He also says in this letter that he's killed seven people at this point. And he says to the police, if you do not put me in the papers, if you don't give me the notoriety that I want, I'm going to kill more until they do. He said, I want national attention. He wrote that, I want national attention. So this incredible narcissism, this desire for attention, this feeling that he can have the police in the palm of his hand, it's very clear, isn't it? Now, it's really difficult for the police at this point, because do they give him what he craves? Do they allow him that notoriety? But if they do that, does it then confirm that he is a serial killer and give him the gravitas to go out and do more killings? That's a difficult decision to make. Because on the other side, he's threatened, if you do not do this, I'm going to kill some other people. That's not a great choice, is it? And the police do decide that they're going to have to go out there and talk about him. One, because there is a serial killer at loose and they need the local population to be aware that their lives are in danger. But also, if they don't do it, he's made it clear he will kill again. So they're in a really challenging position. They go ahead with this. They try to communicate with him through that TV transmission. In fact, they try a very unusual, but at the time, it was considered something that could be affected, a subliminal suggestion technique. And this was done to try to connect the officer in charge of the case with BTK. So they inserted a drawing with a pair of glasses that said, now call the chief. And you wouldn't notice this unless you go and watch it. they slow it down so that you can actually see what it said. There's this pair of spectacles upside down and it says, now call the chief. But it flickers on like a little glitch in the TV. And psychologists believe that if you did this, the killer would lock on to that and would fixate a need to get in contact with the police officer. It didn't work. The reason they did those spectacles was because from the scene of the crime, there was some upside down spectacles. And also he'd written in a letter and kind of drawn these upside down spectacles. So that was going to be the connector. We know it's you. And secondly, we want you to get in contact with us. Call the chief. As I said, didn't work. Gotta say, wasn't the best drawing. Don't want to cause any upset for whoever did that. But it was a bit of a rubbish drawing. I'm just going to say that. Because whenever I looked at it, I'm like, no, not the most convincing thing. And most people would have been like, what is that? But it was done to create a connection. Obviously, it didn't work. Probably because blink and you miss it. Imagine what it would be like to be in a community and suddenly find out that there was somebody within your community that was serial killing. But worse than that, it's been going on a while, meaning that the person who's doing it doesn't stand out. There is always this myth that a person who is that dangerous, that broken, will be an individual that you can have instinct and intuition about. So if they walked into a shop, you'd feel uneasy around them. If you worked next to them, you'd feel that they were slightly odd. It's not the way it works.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woo-hoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply.
What we know about a lot of serial killers, particularly organized serial killers, is that they live amongst us. They are our friends. They are our parents. They are our colleagues. They are our sisters, our brothers. So this experience in the local environment for the community would have been horrifying. It would have caused you to look suspiciously at anyone. The one thing the police do think is it's somebody local, because the radius of the killings suggests so. So again, anybody that you come into contact with at any point, any day, could be BTK. That is horrifying. But he's got his title. He's got his name, because they start referring to him as BTK. And he is proud of that. Remember, this is a man who knows about serial killers. If you watch any of the interviews with him, he knows. He has studied them and he wants to be a good one. I imagine that he's learnt from reading about serial killers. He definitely has learnt about Ted Bundy. So there is, to some degree, a desire to mimic, but I would say to be better than. And I think considering he lasted 30 years doing it, he probably was. At this point, police want to look more at the forensic samples because, as I said, we are getting better at this point technologically. So they look at the sperm again and they look whether he's a secretor or a non-secretor. If he's a non-secretor, it will mean that there isn't blood in the semen. They can't trace it. He was also PGM type 1. This meant that only about 10% of the population would fit that particular category. Now, that still means there was 15,000 people that could potentially be responsible. So it's not like, great, we've got this DNA. It's amazing. We just have to find 15,000 people with this particular genome and we'll be okay. You know, it's not the way that it works. But nonetheless, they were at least trying. And the thing with the police is, throughout the BTK case, oh my God, they never let up. Like I said, two generations of detectives were on this case. They never let up. They're always hoping, one, he's going to make a mistake. Secondly, that they're going to find him through these kind of technological advances, but they're never giving up. Now, after the murder where he calls the police and obviously becomes aware, because the police play that recorded message in the hope that somebody will recognise his voice, that to BTK is a mistake. It's a mistake. He didn't assume that he'd be recorded. And the fact that now somebody has information that does directly relate to him, the fact that somebody could recognise his voice, it spooks him. Remember, when a phone call goes, it spooks him. When people are more chaotic than he imagined, it spooks him. He does not like things out of order. One of the reasons he is such an organised offender is because he works things through accurately. He takes time. He prides himself on that. And it's a mistake as far as he's concerned. Leaving that voice recording, not putting on a different accent or a different voice, just using his own voice, that's a big mistake. So for 3 years, he doesn't do anything. Now, as I've said, the leads in this case were very challenging for the police. There weren't very many leads at all. One of the things that BTK did, again, that was clever, he would write letters, but he wouldn't send the actual letter. He would type them, then he would go to a photocopy machine and he would photocopy them and he would send that to the police. This made it a lot more difficult because of the fact that they couldn't examine the paper, they couldn't get any prints off it. It became a more challenging job. But what they were able to do was to trace the photocopy machine that the letters were photocopied on. So again, they were able to trace that, which is incredible, but unfortunately it was public access, so it was fruitless. Hundreds, thousands of people would go in and put a dime in, you got your photocopy. So the only real evidence they have at this point is the voice recording. And from that, they deciphered he was a white male, and at this point he was likely in his 40s. Spot on, actually. But nonetheless, not exactly helpful. Well, he's a white male in a mostly white area with around 50% of the population being male in his 40s, which is pretty huge. And that's all we really have. Maybe a bushy moustache, according to somebody who saw him. Kevin said that. But you can always shave a moustache off, right? So they are really stuck at this point. Then in the early 80s, the killings seem to have stopped altogether. So you start thinking as an officer, well, maybe it's changed, maybe he's moved away. And I would have imagined there would be a lull of fear because this seems to be quite a gap. And that gap went on for several years. Now, when you listen to Dennis Rader in court, he very openly says, well, I was just really busy. I had kids, I had 2 children, didn't have time for it. He couldn't spend the time stalking and trawling. He couldn't have that time away. It would have aroused suspicion in his family. So what is incredible is he can put it on hold to some degree. However, I will introduce the fact that as much as he could put it on hold, what I will say is he did get up some very strange behaviour, of which I'm going to put a selection of photos here for you so you can see the kind of behaviour he got up to. Because, as I said, he had a particular interest in autoerotic asphyxiation and binding himself. So that's what he did. He bound himself. He took lots of pictures of himself, harrowing pictures that enabled him to get the sexual stimulation. He wanted pictures of somebody that looked bound and hung. So he just created them himself. He was a very artistic little busy bee. And when you see those photographs, they are pretty terrifying, aren't they? So he manages to use the mementos that he's taken from the crime scenes. He can look at jewellery and masturbate over them. And then he takes pictures of himself in all these bizarre, terrifying positions, and he masturbates over those as well. Nothing like a narcissist, eh? Masturbating over themselves. Because that's the kind of personality that they have. So there's this gap. And I imagine there would be some peace restored and people are probably hoping this is just a bad memory, it's faded away. But then in 1985, changes again. 53-year-old Maureen Hedge was found in a ditch on the outskirts of Wichita. She'd been strangled, but the police were really baffled because BTK always used to leave the bodies in situ. So it's not his MO. And what the police are trying to do is to profile to some degree this killer. And this is outside of the normal remit of killing. When BTK is asked about that in court, he basically says, she was only a few doors down. it was really close to home. His own daughter talks about the fact that as a family, they were all talking about how awful it was that their neighbor had disappeared. And then when she was found murdered, everyone was horrified. That's how close to home he'd taken that life. His daughter said that they used to regularly say hello to that particular victim. So he isn't afraid to do this on his own doorstep. There must have been something about that particular woman. There must have been something about Maureen that he couldn't let go of. Maybe it was because he was so busy with his family life. So he wasn't actively trawling, but then he sees her in his local neighborhood and it sparks something, that desire. He can keep a contained lid on this serial killing behavior for a certain amount of time, but there must have been something, the way she moved, the way she was alone, just something that triggered it. He moves that body because he doesn't want the police to find it as quickly as they would do otherwise. And also, she'll be a missing person for a while. This is odd, and I'll tell you this is odd for one reason. He usually has a very clear ritual. That's what makes BTK stand out. It's a very rigorous procedure to the way that he kills. Yes, when he gets spooked, he'll use a knife or a gun, but for the most part, he likes to bind, torture, and kill his victims in situ, and then he leaves. But he's broken that MO. However, arguably, he additionalizes this killing in a new way. He takes Maureen Hedges' body to a church, and he takes lots of explicit photos of her before he disposes of her body. Now, I think when you listen to the way he disassociates and compartmentalizes himself, he sees himself as having this kind of alter ego, this dangerous dark side. And I imagine that side of himself that wanted to go into a church and desecrate it, to show God, who was truly in charge, I'm in charge. I'm omnipotent. I'm omniscient. I'm everywhere. I'm all powerful. And by hanging her up in that church and taking those photos of her, it's about as disrespectful as you can be to the house of God. No matter what your beliefs are, whether you're an atheist, agnostic, true believer, the point is everyone knows that a church is sacrosanct. And therefore, it should not have a scenario play out where a poor woman isn't just horribly murdered, she's then posed sexually in a place that we cannot imagine such things happening in. I think this is also clearly demonstrating the superiority complex that is just thriving in Dennis Radar, aka BTK, because he's getting more loud in the way that he murders. This superiority, this sense that he can get away with anything, he can get away with murder, even in the house of God. And as I said, he's got lots of trophies, so he's constantly enjoying his masturbatory fantasies. He's got all these connections with the people he's murdered. He's got all these pictures of himself in bizarre positions. So he's really living this life perpetually. I think that's important because when we think about him not killing for several years, we might start saying to ourselves, oh, well, does that make sense for a serial killer? When you look at people like the Green River Killer, who killed constantly, you know, up to nearly 100 people, one after the other, because it was almost compulsive. This individual isn't like that. He's controlled. But it's because he enjoys all of it. He doesn't just enjoy the kill. He enjoys every tiny little bit. In fact, to some degree, the kill is the anticlimax in some way. It's the building up, the knowing that, the understanding that at some point in that future, he will snuff out their life. That terrifies me more than anything, because it makes him so calculating. It makes him so patient. It doesn't fit in with what we imagine killing is like. We imagine it, yes, to be vicious. We imagine it, yes, to be horrific, terrifying. We imagine all those things, but do we imagine it being planned over years? No. Even with serial killing, we suspect that this person loses control. They have this impulse control behavior And therefore, when they finally melt down, it's almost become uncontrollable for them. It's not like that with BTK. Oh, he enjoys all of it. He is so cool, calm, and collected. So cold. So able to wait. So another 6 years after Maureen Hedge has died, that Dolores Davies, who's 62, at this moment in time, she's just having a lovely retirement. She's in bed asleep, and suddenly she's awoken by a brick being hurled through her downstairs window. Think about that. You wake up straight away with a start. You're dead disorientated, aren't you? But that would have been what would have happened. But then he's there in front of her. And he actually uses Dolores' own pair of tights. That's in the UK what we call them. In America, it's pantyhose. So he takes those and he strangles her with them. You know, a 62-year-old woman just sleeping. And then he smashes a window, gets in, and murders her with her own tights around her neck. He's also really organised with this one. He's got a complex alibi because he's organised a scout camp so that he needs to be away from near the scene. Even though he goes and does it and then drives back to the camp, and it is noted that he's left, it's enough to give him a really strong alibi. And when forensic psychologists look at BTK and they look at if there was a perfect serial killer, you know, a faultless serial killer who was a number 10, so perfect, he'd get an 8. That is a high score. That is a high score. Because most serial killers are more sloppy and many go from a level of sanity into insanity at some point. So even the most organised offender, organised serial killer, will at some point, as time progresses, maybe it's the pricks of conscience, maybe it's the recognising that there has to be an end to their behaviour, they slide into more sloppy behaviour, which can often end in them being caught. This guy is not like that at all. He's always that same cold, detached, organised murderer. That's what makes him so fucking terrifying. At this point, he's murdered 10 people. Every single lead has gone cold, dead end. How frustrating would that be for the police? This guy has managed to outsmart them all these years. In 2004, technology has changed. It's moved on. And at that point, the semen sample gets reanalyzed and they've got a DNA match, which sounds great. I know. Amazing. They've got a DNA match. They can go and get him. No, they can't. Because we don't have DNA of innocent people, right? We only have DNA of criminals. So they run it and it turns out BTK's never had a criminal record, so they can't find him. Not so much as a driving under the influence or a speeding ticket. He's just not on their radar. They have the DNA profile. It means if he gets caught, they can definitely connect him. But unless he gets caught, unless there is something to connect him, he's going to get away with it. So what changes this? What is the nudge that sends BTK in a direction where he gets caught? Well, it begins with a very simple press release, because somebody has written a book about BTK on the 30th anniversary of the first murder that says that, as far as they're concerned, BTK's history. He's either too old or he's dead. So on one level, you can understand this. May as well make some money. Somebody investigating the case, 30-year anniversary. Probably unlikely that the guy's around anymore. But on the other side of it, arguably, it's pretty clever if you want to wash someone out of retirement, isn't it? We know that this malignant narcissism that BTK has means that it would be very tantalising if somebody thought that they knew better than him. Remember how it was when those three guys came forward? Oh, he didn't like that. He didn't like somebody taking responsibility for his work. So now somebody's written a book suggesting that he isn't around anymore. That's a very difficult thing for a narcissist to swallow. And he can't swallow it. True to form, a letter arrives at the Wichita Eagle building in March 2004, taking responsibility for a murder in 1986 of Vicky Wedderly. So it's back on. And the police at this point think, yes, if we can get this guy to communicate with us more often, we have got a chance. We've got a chance. Technology has moved on. We are smarter now. We can get this guy. So their main aim at this point is, okay, how do we start to get him to communicate with us more? And they want to create a bond. And one of the ways that they do that is they get the detective in charge to do quite a lot of press conferences. And that detective in charge was actually informed by his superiors, we're going to have to be careful because we believe that there is a strong possibility that BTK will home in on you and likely go after you or your family. I'm not being awful. If they said that to me, I'd be like, you know what? I've been thinking for quite a while that I'm exhausted and I think that I want to just go and work in a shop. I would not have been able to do that. I also want to leave the area entirely because it would be terrifying. They have no leads on who this is. It could be anybody. So this police officer who's in charge of the case, all he can do is trust that he's going to find this man. One of the things that is very clear in the press conference is he almost acts submissive, as if he's talking to BTK in a way where he's saying, you know what? We know you know more than us. We know you're an expert. We can't figure out who you are. You are so clever. They didn't belittle him. They made sure that he would feel that he was superior. And the way that they played it was just, we would be really interested to talk to you. But he gave BTK the notoriety he really wanted. And this was like child with candy because BTK likes this situation. Remember, he feels really superior. He's probably a little bit bored at the moment. He's older now. So it probably stirs up a lot of feelings in him and he starts responding. And he does this in a really weird way. He gets letters, puts them in cereal boxes and marks them BTK and leaves them certain places. So some of the things that he also does is send a bound and hung doll, which is a chilling reference to the murder of Josephine Otero. And he also reveals in a letter that he plans to kill again. Imagine being the police officer who reads that, the detective involved in that case who's reading it, that he's told him, I'm going to kill again. He said, I spotted a female that I think lives alone, just have to work out the details. I'm much older now, so I have to condition myself carefully. Got to do it this year or next. Time is running out for me. So we have an insight to his age here, don't we? He's an older guy. Imagine how scary this is for the police. They have to let the public know because they're terrified and they want the public to be terrified because people have to be aware that BTK isn't dead and he's certainly not too old to kill again. And also, he selected his victim. So they are time limited in bringing him to justice. For 10 months, the police play cat and mouse. And then on one fateful day, BTK, the malignant superior narcissist, he makes a mistake, a fateful mistake. He leaves a package in an open back truck in a parking lot, but he fails to notice the CCTV. Easy mistake. And the police analyze 2,000 hours of CCTV, and there he is. And they watch him pull out the package and place it in the truck. And now the police have got his vehicle. Now listen, it was old style CCTV. They can't tell the number plate of the car, but they put it through analysis. And what they can find out is that BTK drove in a black Jeep Cherokee. So now they have DNA and they have his car. That's all they have, but that's a lot more than they did. Then he writes to the police and asks whether a computer floppy disk could be traced back to who authored it. And he says, If you promise, i.e. the police, that it can't be, I'll communicate that way on it from now. Think about that for a second. BTK, probably one of the most sophisticated, successful, and organized serial killers America has ever seen, asks the police, I'm thinking about using this floppy disk. I will get in touch with you by computer if you just reassure me that you'll not be able to trace it back to me. Is that okay? Because, of course, BTK has the God delusion. He can't believe for one minute that the police would lie to him. He's outsmarted these idiots for years. So the police set a trap in a newspaper, and the advert says, Rex, it will be okay. Contact me, P.O. Box, first four reference numbers at 67202. And he fell for it. He literally believed the police. He was like, oh, the police, they've said that they can't trace back a floppy disk. That must be the truth then. I mean, for all his sophistication, that's pretty stupid, isn't it? That if the police tell you that they're not going to be able to track it, they're not going to be able to track it. He doesn't think, oh, maybe this is a ruse, you know, at the end of the day. Probably want to catch me. Maybe they'll just say no and actually mean absolutely, we'll absolutely be able to trace it. So BTK sends them a disc. And immediately that goes over to forensics team. Because what BTK didn't realize was that Microsoft embeds something called metadata. And metadata is information about the file, and you can get access to that by going to the file properties, and then the software in those properties is registered to the owner. And that shows up, the owner's name. And on this occasion, it showed up Christ Lutheran Church. Police straight on Google immediately. And they find that the church is just north of Wichita. They also see that the document has last been saved by a person called Dennis. I can just imagine the feeling in their bellies when they're doing this. They're like, he fell for it. He sent us the floppy disk. It's directly related back to a church. And the guy who sent it and saved it is called Dennis. So after 31 years, they've got a name. They then immediately Google the church, and it gets better. Because on a link about who was involved with the church, who we are, there we have it. Dennis Rader, president of the congregation. There you go, Dennis. Best disguise ever. Ingratiate yourself to your local church. Who's going to believe that you are Satan's son? They drove there straight away. And when they got there, second confirmation, the Black Jeep Cherokee. And whilst they all wanted to run in and grab him, the detective said, no, come back. I want you all back. And he pulled them back because he said, it's still too circumstantial. We need more. So, unbeknown to Dennis Rader, unbeknown to his family, in fact, the police looked at his daughter's medical records and they were able to get some DNA. From that DNA, they secretly collected it. They recognised that it was a 99.9% match, meaning that Dennis Rader was confirmed to be the parent, meaning that it was his DNA. They were a match. At that point, imagine how ecstatic they feel. And they're going to arrest him. They got him at 12 p.m. as he was on his way home for lunch. And the detective who arrested him, remember, this is two generations of officers who spent over 30 years trying to bring this man to justice, trying to get justice for the victims of those heinous crimes. He described it as a fun occasion. He said, it was the best feeling I ever had in my entire life. I'm sure his wife will probably be a bit angry about that. I do kind of question the detective's choice to say the best ever, but I think one of the best feelings would have been better. I'm just saying it as a woman, I would have taken issue with that, particularly if I had children. I'd be like, what do you mean? Surely the birth of your first child would be better than this. But I understand what he was saying professionally. It was a fun occasion. It was the greatest feeling that he'd ever had. And at the press conference, there is this moment. You know, a lot of people have got pomp and ceremony, haven't they? But there's just this sheriff, and he comes out, and all he says is, the bottom line, BTK is arrested. And the whole room erupts. People are celebrating, absolutely celebrating. It's over. They've got him. He spent 30 hours in interrogation. And let me tell you, when you watch it, for a lot of that period of time, the first 3 hours, he's completely stonewalling. He does not give them a thing. Remember, he's superior. He's a malignant narcissist. He doesn't believe that the police are that clever. He probably thinks that this is just carrying on that cat and mouse. He'll get away with it. He'll go out, carry on. You know, they're all mates now. This has been going on for such a long time. But 3 hours in, they basically say, we've got your bank to rights, Dennis. We've got your DNA. We've got your link to all these crimes. And at that point, he says, I am BTK. The 27th of June, 2005, he goes to court and, oh my God, watch it. I invite all of you to watch his confession when he's going guilty for every single one of the murders. I invite you to watch it because there is something so unbelievably ordinary about this man. And the matter-of-fact way that he describes what he did, the helpfulness he gives to the judge when he's asking specifics, if it wasn't talking about cold-blooded, sadistic, sexual sadism murder, you would probably think he's the kind of guy you'd go for a pint with. That's how detached he is. He's just going through the motions of describing events without any attachment to feelings. It's this matter-of-fact tone whilst looking like a completely normal person. Dennis Rader, BTK, was a family man. He had two kids, but all he craved was power and dominion over people around him. His daughter said that her childhood was perfect. They actually demolished the family home a few years after this all happened because people in the local area didn't want any reminders of that monster. But for his child, his daughter, all she knew of him was a loving parent, somebody who camped with her, took her fishing. They had a great relationship. Can you imagine the jump you'd have to make seeing your father go from caring, loving papa to sexual, sadist, serial killer? It's uncomfortable, isn't it, to imagine that anybody would have to go through that. And you're often guilty by association. People always think, well, how did his wife not know? How did his daughter not know? But how didn't the police know? Because he compartmentalized his killing so excellently. And he didn't kill constantly. He was selective. He enjoyed the kill. Oh, but he loved the chase. To those around him, Dennis Rader was an all-round good guy. And guess what his job was? He fitted security locks. Security locks. So people were inviting him into their home to make them more secure. Unwittingly inviting their own murderer, potentially, to understand how their house was laid out, who was at home, what their life was like. Perfect ruse, perfect job. He also ran the Boy Scouts, although sometimes that doesn't surprise me. I've worked on quite a lot of cases where paedophiles run the Boy Scouts. Obviously, that's not to say for 1 minute to anybody listening who runs the Boy Scouts that I think that the leaders of Boy Scouts are paedophiles. I'm just saying, if you want to give yourself a guise of respectability, it's a good place to go. Same as the church, but we all know what's happened there as well. His colleagues loved him. People worked with him for over a decade said, you know what? I understand that his wife wouldn't have known. He was the person that everyone liked. Everyone wanted to be around. He was an all-round good guy. There was nothing about him that stood out. Now, what we know is that Dennis Radar was able to live that dual life without any sliding into insanity. He was perfectly capable of being a mass murderer.
Riley Herbst from 2311 Racing here. And you know what grinds my gears? Waiting for coffee. But instead of counting frappes and lattes, I fire up Chumba Casino. No apps, no fuss, just fun social casino games to pass the time. By the time my coffee's ready,
order for Riley.
I've already taken a few victory laps. Next time you're stuck waiting, make it entertaining. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Murderer and a stand-up guy, friend, neighbor, partner, father. That's what makes him really unusual, because he could hold those two mindsets in perfect synchronicity without sliding into either, so that he was able to completely split. His family knew one Dennis Radar, his killers knew the other, BTK. And he studied serial killers, and he studied police. As I said, he got his degree in justice services. So he was interested in all of that area. And that's what was so incredible about this man. He used his intelligence, his cunning, his interests to formulate ways to create the perfect kill. He also said that his favorite death was of Nancy Fox. It was the most satisfying crime, he said. She was the least unpredictable. She did what he said without too much mess. And so for him, she came closest to his perfect fantasy kill. Whereas in the situation with Catherine and Kevin, where it all went wrong, that was his nightmare kill. Even the Oteros was not perfect because there were so many problems with initially killing them. The first kill was a struggle. He hadn't practiced strangulation on humans, therefore it kept going wrong. But nonetheless, by Nancy Fox, he felt he'd got it right. One of the things that Dennis Radar believed as BTK was that every single one of the people that he murdered would serve him in the afterlife. Don't ask me where he got that stuff from, but who knows what goes on in the mind of a perfectly sane but completely sadomasochistic killer. But that's what he believed. He also believed that the behaviour that he used must have been because he was taken over by a darkness, by a devil-like creature. That's just a way of allaying any responsibility. It wasn't me. It was just the bad guy who got into me temporarily. I'm a good guy, really. It's absolute rubbish, but we see it. It's quite common. And it's very easy, isn't it? If I can explain away my behaviour by suggesting that I'm not in control of that behaviour when it happens, then it wasn't really me who did it. But that just is a way of perfectly compartmentalising our behaviours. And it's the way of never being completely responsible for what you've done. Now, Radar escaped execution. He wouldn't have done if it had been in more modern times, because the death penalty has been reinstituted. But in Kansas, at the time of the murders that he carried out, it wasn't. It's bizarre, that, isn't it? It's bizarre that because it had only been reinstituted after the murders had happened, he could not be put to death, even though he wasn't tried until a time when actually it was able to be instituted. So he got away with it. He was given consecutive life sentences of 175 years. So of course, he's never ever gonna get to walk the streets again. We are safe from that. But imagine being somebody who had maybe killed somebody, one event, maybe not meant to kill them, maybe in a robbery gone wrong, and you find yourself with the death penalty in Kansas because you happen to have committed the crime when that death penalty had been reinstituted. Would you think that was fair? That Dennis Radar, BTK, serial sadistic masochistic murderer, was able to get away with just serving his life, getting on with it till he dies? Seems a little bit unfair to me. Just throwing it out there. Just think if they're going to kill people who did loads less, probably isn't right that he gets to carry on living his life. I'm not for the death penalty. I'm just saying, doesn't make sense to me. Not when you look at what he did. I wonder how you feel about BTK. There is something chilling, isn't there, about the fact that he was so comfortable with killing, so comfortable with the trawling, with the locking in, with the stalking, and then with the planning the death. He had a murder kit that he carried everywhere. It was full of rope and duct tape and guns and knives. Imagine taking that around with you, always knowing that if you found that perfect victim, you were ready for the kill. And I often wonder, because he said in court, often he'd have several people he'd be stalking. So even though he enjoyed the kill, the fact that he didn't kill multiple more people suggests that it was far bigger, the picture for him. It was this constant desire to be able to feel that you hold all of these people's potential deaths in your hands. It wasn't necessarily just the execution of the murder. It was the knowing that any of those that you were following could end up bound, tortured, and killed at your hands. And that's what drove BTK. I'm not going to say I hope you've enjoyed this. It's horrific, isn't it? What a horrific human being that's still breathing, that's still living, that's still walking, that's still fed. You know, this man really does feel like he was born to kill, doesn't he? You can't help but imagine that this individual just had all of those facets within him that were required to be the kind of executioner he was. And that makes me wonder. It makes me wonder that Dennis Rader stands out because
that's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
He did have a really happy marriage and children. And yet, he was a serial killer. Did that foundation, growing up in a well-adjusted environment, in spite of the fact that from an early time he was interested in sadistic killing, was it that foundation of ordinariness that gave him the stability that many serial killers don't have? You look at a lot of serial killers' lives, they were traumatic early on. They had sexual abuse. They were privy to horrifically traumatic information and experience. Maybe what sets Dennis Rader aside, a little bit like Ted Bundy, is that to be a really sophisticated, successful serial killer, you actually need to have had a reasonably nice childhood, which kind of goes against the grain of what we expect where these kind of offenders are concerned. Maybe it was that foundation that was indeed his secret weapon.